They were arrested while they were working as journalists. I don't think they have harmed the interests of the state.
Myanmar remands two Reuters journalists into custody for at least 14 more days. It's Thursday, December 28th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Remember, you're a part of the program. You can join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, South Korea says its agreement with Japan over comfort women was incomplete. How are Afghan refugees facing the winter cold? And we'll go ice fishing in China. That's all on today's VOA Asia. Thank you for being with us. A court in Myanmar has extended the detention of two Reuters journalists for at least two more weeks. Wa Lone and Cho So-woo were arrested December 12th, allegedly for possessing secret important papers. The area around the court was packed with journalists, police, and government officials as the two men emerged from a police van. Wa Lone said the two men had just been carrying out their jobs as journalists and have never violated journalistic ethics. Cho So-woo said that whatever they were working on, they followed media ethics, and no one can arrest journalists like this. Wa Lone's wife said that she wanted her husband to be free soon and that he would never violate the rules of law. She said, "I want my husband to be free soon, and I trust in him that he would never violate the rules of law. He has good morals, and I trust him, so he should be free soon." The two reporters were arrested for violating a British colonial-era law called the Official Secrets Act, which is punishable by up to 14 years in prison. They had allegedly acquired what the government calls important secret papers from two police officers who had been working in Rakhine State, the site of the Myanmar military's crackdown on ethnic Rohingyas. The brutal crackdown started in August in response to attacks on police outposts. The military response has been condemned as ethnic cleansing by the UN and has led to more than 650,000 Rohingyas fleeing to neighboring Bangladesh. Meanwhile, a spokesman for Myanmar's de facto civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, says the country is saddened by a U.S. decision to sanction a military commander linked to abuses against the Rohingya minority. The Trump administration announced December 21st that it is sanctioning General Maung Maung So, who was in charge of a crackdown on the Rohingya in Rakhine State. The United States said American officials had examined credible evidence of Maung Maung So's activities, including allegations against Burmese security forces of extrajudicial killings, sexual violence, and arbitrary arrest, as well as the widespread burning of villages. The military and the civilian government of Aung San Suu Kyi have denied allegations of widespread abuse in Rakhine. We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream, at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and on the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. U.S. and Russia agree to continue diplomacy over North Korea. Taliban suicide bombers attack Afghan army base. Crime eases in the Philippines, a laurel for embattled President Duterte. An Australian woman is acquitted of drug trafficking charges in Malaysia. And Vietnam unveils a 10,000-strong cyber unit to combat wrong views. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday. I'm David Byrd in Washington, and VOA Asia continues. South Korea's foreign ministry said Wednesday that the country's agreement with Japan over South Korean victims of World War II sex slavery was insufficient. South Korea's foreign minister, Kang Kyung-hwa, said Wednesday that the Seoul government's actions did not reflect a victim-oriented approach to resolving a human rights issue.
특히 피해자 중심 접근이라는 인권 I express my deepest apologies and regrets for hurting the hearts of civic groups who have been supporting the victims and their families and all our citizens for the fact that the universal standard of victim-oriented approach for resolving a human rights issue was not sufficiently reflected in the 2015 agreement at the time it was reached.
Japan's Foreign Minister Taro Kono issued a statement urging Seoul to continue to honor the deal, warning that bilateral ties would be damaged if South Korea tries to amend it. The pact was reached between Seoul and Tokyo under the administration of ousted President Park Geun-hye. President Moon Jae-in ordered a special task force to look into the deal shortly after he took office in July. The head of the task force, Oh Tae-kyu, said Wednesday that the deal includes undisclosed parts, including some related to statues and monuments for comfort women. He said such issues like comfort women, which is a matter of both universal values and perception of history, cannot be resolved by a political agreement through short-term diplomatic negotiations. Also, issues like comfort women are a common interest of the international community that cannot be resolved by a bilateral agreement. The Japanese government has been demanding that South Korea remove several monuments to the comfort women, including outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul and the Japanese consulate in Busan. Japan apologized for the action of its troops during its brutal rule of the Korean Peninsula between 1910 and 1945. It also agreed to pay $9 million into a fund established to support the victims. Historians believe that up to 200,000 women, mostly from Korea as well as other parts of Asia, were forced into sexual slavery during World War II. Authorities in Xinjiang province in western China have launched what they called a new Relatives Week program earlier this month, which requires local civil servants to spend a week with Uyghur families in rural areas by the year's end. However, as VOA's Doug Bernard tells us, the ethnic Uyghurs don't see the time as warming relations between them and the majority Han Chinese.
Beginning December 11th, thousands from the northwestern province traveled to the countryside and lodged with Uyghur families for a week-long stay of eating, drinking, and forming a family bond with members of the ethnic group, according to state media. While a percentage of those may be ethnic Uyghurs or distant relatives to Uyghurs, observers say many are still Han people from local government departments, public schools, or the judiciary. Uyghurs have no choice but to take in the participants, who also serve as the authorities' mouthpiece to hold home-based propaganda sessions and preach about the so-called spirits of China's 19th National Congress, following the twice-per-decade meeting, which was wrapped up in late October. Adrian Zentz, a German-based researcher, called the Relatives Week an intensified, intrusive measure. But he said it's nothing new, as similar security and social controls have been in place before.
So it's obviously surveillance. But they are looking to gather information, obviously look for signs of trouble, of what is defined as extremism, etc.
Prior to this, tens of thousands in Xinjiang were sent to live in the villages, people who Zentz said helped the local government have a better grasp of any potential racial unrest among the ethnic group. The researcher added that the security in Xinjiang is getting tighter than ever. A recent Wall Street Journal report described the capital city of Xinjiang as one of the most closely surveilled places on Earth, where citizens and visitors, quote, alike must run a gauntlet of police checkpoints, surveillance cameras, and machines scanning their ID cards, faces, eyeballs, and sometimes even entire bodies. Zentz said these stepped-up securitization and policing strategies may have enjoyed a short-term success, but will provide unsustainable in the long run, as they bear both economic and interracial risks, as well as the alienation of the local Han population.
The maintenance of very high pressure and stress over long periods of time is creating a strong liability, a strong risk in the long term. The pressure of the securitization is felt by everybody. It's also impacting the Han. And the Han in Xinjiang are very important for the government. And so alienating them is a major risk.
Online comments toward the new Relatives Week program are mostly favorable, although some sound slightly sarcastic. For reporter Joyce Huang, I'm Doug Bernard.
Happening now in Asia, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has called for protests across Russia on January 28th to support a boycott of the country's upcoming presidential election. Polls show that President Vladimir Putin is likely to win another six-year term. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov have agreed to continue to work toward a diplomatic solution to achieve a denuclearized Korean peninsula. The U.S. State Department said Wednesday that the two men spoke by phone on Tuesday to discuss concerns related to North Korea's destabilizing nuclear program, and they emphasized that neither the United States nor Russia accepts Pyongyang as a nuclear power. One day earlier, Russia's foreign ministry said that Lavrov had told his American counterpart that Washington's aggressive rhetoric has heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. Russia also said that Lavrov called U.S. rhetoric unacceptable. Meanwhile, the U.S. Treasury Department announced that it had imposed sanctions on two North Korean officials for their role in Pyongyang's ballistic missile program. The move followed the U.N. Security Council's unanimous approval of a resolution last Friday that limited the amount of gasoline and diesel that North Korea can import and tightened inspections of ships suspected of illegally carrying banned items to or from North Korea. As the winter sets in, the United Nations Refugee Agency plans to distribute aid to more than 2,700 needy families and internally displaced persons, or IDPs, in the western Afghan province of Herat. Many of the displaced come from nearby Afghan provinces, where ongoing fighting and insecurity have made it impossible to remain in their homes. John Walker narrates this report by Khalil Norzai on their plight from a camp in Herat City.
The challenges are almost too many to count for those who have fled violence near their homes and sought shelter here in Herat City.
I have so many problems. I don't have a place to live, and I have two handicapped sons who can't work, so I have to work to make a living.
In hopes of providing some relief, the United Nations and local Afghan officials launched a winter distribution program on December 17th, giving money and supplies to nearly 3,000 families who are either internally displaced people, IDPs, or have been repatriated to Afghanistan.
The program also provides aid to Herat's needy families, as well as people with special needs.
$200 and four blankets are provided to every family. Afghan officials say the government will try to grant plots of land to people so they can build homes for themselves.
All IDPs will receive a land lot. The most vulnerable IDPs, including women and children, will receive special attention.
Some of the displaced who have received aid say living conditions here are harsh and that the help will not last long, especially during the winter season.
My only son, who was the breadwinner and was serving in Afghanistan Army in Qalaynaw, capital of Badghis province, was killed in service. My husband can hardly make a living for our family.
Others are calling on the government to bring peace to their provinces so they can return home.
The government should provide security in our villages and provinces so we can go back to our farms, start farming, and make a living. We are living a refugee life inside our own country.
The Herat Provincial Department of Refugees and Repatriations says more than 14,000 refugees, including 10,000 IDPs, are living in various camps and shelters in Herat. For Khalil Norzai in Herat, I'm John Walker, VOA News.
Coming up, we'll visit a frozen lake in China for a little ice fishing. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This news from VOA Asia, a 54-year-old Australian woman was spared the hangman's noose after being acquitted by a Malaysian court of charges of illicit drug trafficking. The judge agreed with the lawyers for Maria Elvira Pinto Exposto that she had been tricked by an online boyfriend into carrying drugs in her backpack in Kuala Lumpur. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. Atop a lake covered by thick ice, fishermen in northeast China cast out the first net for this year's Winter Fishing Festival. It's an ancient yearly tradition that these days is as much an international spectator sport as it is a source of food. Arash Arabasadi reports.
On a frozen lake in China, fishermen gather for an annual winter fishing festival said to be 1,000 years old. The fire ritual is for good luck in catching the fish swimming below the ice. Fishermen say that choosing the right spot to cast the giant 3,000-meter net is critical to the hunt.
Looking at the lake, the low-lying area is bigger, with larger water depth and more bubbles. It must have many fish here.
Hours pass and the fishermen tighten their net, pulling up around 100,000 kilograms of fish. The fishermen scoop them from the net while visitors look on.
I'm an owner of a restaurant, and I'm here choosing some great fish. We all know fish here at the Linhuan Lake are good. On the first day of winter fishing, many customers have pre-ordered fish.
The caught fish are stored in a glass enclosure, and fishermen in this northeastern region say they'll cast the net through the middle of January. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
This news now from VOA Asia. The Australian Super Maxi Wild Oats 11 smashed the race record as they won their ninth Sydney to Hobart Blue Water Classic on Wednesday in 1 day, 8 hours, 48 minutes, 50 seconds. However, the yacht could face the possibility of a protest from the second place finisher because they almost collided near the start. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. There's a good chance that the year that's about to end, 2017, will go down in the history of medicine as a year when genetic engineering finally started moving from research labs to clinics. Several successful stories coming from different parts of the world promise that hereditary diseases and cancers may soon be conquered. VOA's George Pudish looks back at a few of these stories.
Amazing grace.
17-year-old Christian Guardino from Long Island is a celebrated semi-finalist in the TV reality show America's Got Talent. But he's also famous for something even more important. Due to a congenital disease, Christian lost his eyesight at a very young age. Using gene editing, doctors at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia managed to repair the faulty gene, not only for Christian, but for other patients.
When the correct copy of the gene is delivered to their retinas, they can begin to see.
Editing the long strands of DNA molecules that form our genetic picture involves inserting a harmless virus that contains the corrective gene into the affected tissue, in this case, the retina. As retina cells multiply, the corrective gene spreads out and slowly repairs all other cells. Doctors from Italy and Germany used the combination of gene editing and stem cell therapy to save the life of a Syrian boy suffering from a debilitating genetic skin disease that caused constant painful blisters and open sores. Doctors took a small piece of the boy's skin, altered it to correct the genetic flaw, combined it with stem cells, and grew new skin that was grafted onto the boy's body, eventually replacing most of his damaged skin.
This kid is back to his normal life again. That's what we dreamed of doing, and it was possible.
At 44, Brian Madeau is among the oldest survivors of a rare genetic syndrome that typically kills patients much earlier.
I've lived so long that I'm pretty happy I've gotten this far.
Using a tool called CRISPR, doctors repaired the defective genes in some of Madeau's liver cells and injected them into his blood. When the repaired cells reached his liver, they transferred the changes to other cells in a fix that appears to be permanent. Critics say that gene therapies are very expensive and success stories are infrequent, but researchers are optimistic that permanent cures for many hereditary diseases are now within reach. George Putich, VOA News.
You might have heard of autonomous cars, but when it comes to autonomous vehicles, putting them in the relatively open skies might be easier than putting them on crowded roads. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us how one branch of the U.S. military, the Marines, is investigating the use of autonomous helicopters.
The pilot in this helicopter is basically along for the ride. This autonomous chopper is doing all the hard work.
The helicopter itself has its own brain, basically, and it thinks for itself. But I will tell it when to land and when I need it by. And I also have the ability to tell it to go away if I don't need it anymore.
The helicopter runs via an app. The user doesn't have to do much more than give the chopper a destination.
Well, it actually plans the mission on board the aircraft. It navigates to wherever you send it by just giving it supervisory commands. You don't give it detailed planning. It avoids obstacles in a route. It avoids wires, trees, any obstacle it might interact with, and then goes to a landing zone that it knows nothing about, just like a pilot would.
For the military, the decision to investigate autonomous aircraft is all about saving lives and being practical.
We say that why would I put a Marine through a contested doorway when I can put a robot there first? So the same thing when you take it bigger with unmanned aircraft. There are certain things we can do with it that we can't do with manned systems, like just the rest hours that a human requires, or going into a high-threat environment or a GPS-denied or comms-denied environment that we expect in the future. So the unmanned systems give us more options.
While the Marine Corps is doing the initial experimentation, there is a long list of professions that could benefit from the autonomous helicopter technology.
The firefighting situation going out in California, they're put in harm's way every day, the pilots and crews. So having something that they could send out there, do the mission without someone on board or limited crew is certainly a worthwhile investment.
This is not the first time the Marines have experimented with unmanned choppers. A pair of K-MAX autonomous cargo choppers delivered millions of pounds of cargo in Afghanistan between 2011 and 2013. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
And we have this late news item. One person was killed and 12 others injured when a bus carrying Chinese tourists rammed into a car in bad weather in Iceland on Wednesday. Icy roads and harsh weather were reported in the crash. The bus rammed a car carrying Lithuanian tourists before going off the road and overturning. The most seriously injured were taken by helicopter to Reykjavik, about 250 kilometers from the scene of the accident. Tourism is a growing sector in Iceland, which welcomed a record number of 1.8 million visitors in 2016. The number of tourists coming from China has tripled between 2014 and 2016, when 67,000 visited the small volcanic island nation of 335,000. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. And you can find us at voanews.com. Let us hear from you, VOA Asia Facebook, and you can send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.